So you just open your DM and bam, there it is.
Yeah. That like, is hey, cool. Wouldn't you like this? Or did tigers look like this? I mean, stupid.
Yo show. All right. Welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm great. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here.
Oh, look at that. It's an honor. Same. We're going to talk about your podcast, Misunderstood, but I want to know more about you. I want to go back to when you were a kid. I know you were born in Alaska, you moved to Manhattan, but you as a, let's say, 7-8 year old child, how was your life? How are you at that time?
Oh, you know, at 7 or 8, I probably was not the happiest kid because, as you said, I was from Alaska. My parents got divorced when I was 5. I moved just with my mom to New York, and then she started working and had a housekeeper be my parent kind of for, you know, that whole time. So that kind of time in my life, I really remember being raised by this woman, Pat, who was from Antigua, who was the greatest woman ever. And I loved her, but I loved her like a mom because she, it's so funny. Nobody's ever asked me about her because, you know, she took care of me. She picked me up from school. She made me dinner. She was there. And then my mom was starting to go on dates. So my mom was like never home. So Pat was a huge part of my life.
Did that make you resent your mom at all?
Yeah, my mother and I to this day do not get along for a multitude of reasons, but I think that had to do with it. And then I think my mother thought because she was in therapy that I should go to therapy because she had heard that, you know, when parents separate and kids move to a different state or whatever and start a whole new life that they're, you know, they're closed off. And so she sent me to therapy. I went twice a week, every Tuesday and Thursday from 5 to 6 for like, I don't know, from when I was maybe 6 years old to like 11, it was terrible. And I would sit there and I would be silent and the woman would just take notes. And then she'd try to have me play with toys. She'd try to have me draw pictures. But that's what made me angry because I thought I was being labeled that something was wrong with me because my parents had something wrong with them, you know, or getting a divorce or whatever it was that they couldn't work out.
So basically she just didn't want to try to figure out things with you. She'd rather send you somewhere else. If there were, and there couldn't have been, and there might have been nothing wrong with you at all.
Well, no, I mean, listen, I would tell you, like, I now looking back as an older woman, I can look back and say there was really nothing wrong with me. I was very angry and closed off to my mother because she had taken me away from everything that I had known. My father, Alaska, which is such a different place than New York City. And my father had a son from a marriage before. So I had a brother, an older brother who I knew in Alaska. I didn't end up seeing my brother again after my parents got divorced until I was in boarding school and I ran away from boarding school and he came and picked me up and I was 14 years old and I had left when I was 5. So it was a really, you know, my childhood kind of sucked, to be honest.
Your dad passed away at 5, correct?
My dad passed away when I was 15. He was 44.
They separated at 5.
Yes, they separated.
What's your fondest memory of your dad then?
So my dad had a plane in Alaska, like a seaplane, and so he would take me fishing, and I have all these great photos of me sitting on like, you know, one of the rudders or whatever the hell you call that, and yeah. You know, he had the big boots on, and you know he was trying to show me how to fish, and then he would bring me to. My parents started cable television in Anchorage. So he would bring me to the television station all the time. And I remember, that. So I have, you know, my dad was a big guy. You loved him to the extreme. You either loved him or you hated him. He had a big personality. I think I get that from him. People like me to the extreme, nowhere in the middle. And, you know, he made a great impression on me. I thought he could do no wrong.
So for your father, great relationship. For your mother, not so great.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it probably had to do with the fact that, you know, she was struggling with her relationship with him and it came out as resentment of me. And then she took me away to New York. I don't think because she was really meant to be a mother. I think it was because she was trying to, you know, get back at him. She doesn't really have that gene in her. She's a workhorse. She's like an A-type personality. She's always been president of her company or owned her own company, or to this day she's almost 80 and she, you know, she's like a Renaissance woman. She has a new job, a PhD, a this or that. She's now gotten back into acting. She used to be on soap operas, so now she's doing stand-ins and acting gigs, and you know, good for her.
Okay, so you go throughout your childhood with your mom. You run away from boarding school. Your brother picks you up. That's your first time. You've seen your brother in a while, correct?
I hadn't seen him since I was five, yeah, or maybe even four. So I went to, my mother sent me to a boarding school called Sea-Doo in the San Bernardino Mountains. And Sea-Doo, I think it's got on some people's radars because Paris Hilton talks about Sea-Doo. She went to the Sea-Doo schools. I think she was sent to Sea-Doo for a few days. She ran away or left, and then she went to the Provo Canyon sister schools. Sea-Doo school was the original therapeutic boarding school based on the Synanon cult, which treated these kids terribly. I've never seen her documentary, so I don't know per se what she went through. We were all abused, never physically. I want to be clear about that. Which is very hard because there's no evidence, right? I mean, it was really terrible what we went through. I graduated from there. I was there for 3 years. So I went when I was basically 13 and I graduated right before my 17th birthday. And it's a cult. And they didn't realize until maybe 5 years ago that it was based on the Synanon cult. We were always taught Sea-Doo stood for see yourself and do something with it. And we later found out that it was the initials of Charles E. Diedrich, who was the person who founded the Synanon cult. And everything that we did was really based on beating our past out of us, but we were kids. You know, this was built for people who were alcoholics, the Synanon cult. And some kids were sent there from having truancy problems and alcohol and being promiscuous and all. I wasn't. I was a bad kid because I hated my mom and I wanted attention and no one would listen to me. And you got a lot of famous kids. Famous people's kids that came there, even when I was there, Dudley Moore's son was in my peer group. You know, Barbara Walters' kid was there. Jesse Diamond was there, Neil Diamond's son. So we had a lot of kids who just were ignored by parents. But then we had a lot of kids who were arrested for really bad crimes, and the court sent them there as a last ditch effort. It's very expensive, especially at the time I was there in the 1989 to 1991. It was like $75,000 a year to be there. But some of the things we had to do, I had to like dig a grave with a spoon and lay in it.
And what was that supposed to prove? Like what they say that taught you? Like that, I read about that, but what was that supposed to teach you?
I think the physical work teaches you discipline, and it makes you stay within your own head, right? And you have to think, and you have to think about, and they give you writing assignments. And then the epitaph was to bring people to the point where if you were gonna die, here's what people would say about you. Do you wanna live? You have to make the choice to live. If you're gonna keep running away, if you're gonna keep talking back to your parents, if you're gonna keep doing drugs, you're not choosing to live. So I think that was what that exercise was about. But you know, again, 3 years of exercises like that are terrible. And now like on Netflix, there's all these shows about, I forget what it's called right now. There's something called The Program. That is Sea-Doo. Mm-hmm. You know, there's one out about a wilderness program where people are dying or going through 21 day wilderness. We were woken up in the middle of the night and taken away and had to go on a 21 day wilderness program and survive on our own. And it was terrible. And I went through this when I was, you know, 13 to 16, and you're not allowed to flirt. You're not allowed to have a boyfriend. You're not allowed, you know, you get in a lot of trouble and you can't listen to certain music. You can't wear makeup. You know, so you asked me about my childhood and there you go. That until I was 17,
wow.
That was my childhood. I've never lived at home then since I was 12 years old.
Okay. So before I move forward, I want to go back because I want to know what happened to the lady that took care of you. Was it, because I know at times, and I've seen this where from one of my friends, I won't name, but one day their kid went to, I guess, the nanny instead of the mom, and the mom took great offense to that and let go of the nanny. Did that ever happen with your mom where she got so insecure about this lady taking care of you and you loving this lady that she kind of let her go?
No, actually, Pat. So Pat is probably, let's see, if my mom's 78 or so, Pat is almost maybe 90 or in her 90s. My mother goes and visits her every year in whatever home she's in. We send her money. You know, she's met my daughter. She stopped working for us when I was, you know, 13, or I think she probably stayed around for a year to take care of the dog or whatever after I was sent away to boarding school. But then my mom didn't have much use for her. I think she stayed on as a housekeeper for a little bit. And then she got rid of her, but she still visits her. She sends her money. I send her money and I take care of her. It's making me feel emotional talk about her. Cause, I love her more than my mom and I don't spend, you know, I don't check in with her enough, but her daughter writes me. I think it's hard for me to connect with her cause it brings up such hard feelings. Sorry.
No, I understand. Like, you know, a lot of your story I read about, you know, I know about your childhood. I'm like, man, that must be so tough. And then to grow up and face like the real world when you had that kind of childhood. Oh, it has to be tough.
Yeah, well, I think that I grew up really not feeling like I had a backbone. Like, I had a backbone, but I didn't have a family that like had my back. And obviously I've been through a lot of things where I needed someone to take my side, and I didn't have that, you know?
With a running theme I'm hearing, because I know you were in this school, a lot of people will be not have sympathy or empathy for you because they're like, she comes from money. And I'm sure you've heard that before, where it's like, oh, there's people that are, you know, don't have as much money and they have less problems. Do you feel like money was the root of the problem with your family? Or because I hear running theme, you named a couple of really famous people that were in this place with you, in different places with you. And it almost seems like the more successful people are, the less they pay attention a lot of times to their kids.
Right. Well, I have heard that I've come from money. I have grandparents that have started with nothing and built themselves up and had a lot of money. My grandmother is the one that paid for that school because of my father. My father and my mother, when they met, my mom was a starving actress, which meant she was working at a restaurant, and she met my dad that way. And they went to Alaska with $1,000 between the two of them because my father was in a fight with his father and wanted to prove he could make it on his own. And from there, with that $1,000, he was able to do enough things, I won't get into the story, but to end up buying a satellite dish to create cable television. So I come from entrepreneurs that start with nothing and make a lot, and then get nothing and make a lot again. So I didn't grow up spoiled at all. I lived on 100, my mother, when she moved to New York, we lived on 100th Street in Central Park West, which was basically the equivalent of Beirut. It's like Harlem. I was like, you know, it was not, people wouldn't come to our home because they thought it was too far north in Manhattan. I was never spoiled. You know, I have not, you know, my grandparents were wealthy, but I'm not their child, right? My father was wealthy, but he died when I was younger. And by the way, he had a lot of money when he died. It was all left to my brother and I, but he had spent most of the money that he had on cocaine. So there wasn't a lot left. And no one has supported me my whole life. I've never been married to someone who supported me. I lived, you know, off of the little bit of money that I got from my dad. I paid for my own college. I paid for my own cars, like literally everything I had. I don't think that people realize that I'm a hustler by nature because I'm scared of being destitute. I'm scared of not having enough for myself, my daughter, my dogs. That's my unit. You know, and I don't have an ex-husband that pays, you know, a lot of child support or anything. And I just live a nice life. I think that's a fantasy in people's mind that I come from money. I come from people who are very successful and who have had money, but that has not translated to me.
Okay. So let's move ahead to like 18, 19 years old. What are you doing now?
I went to college. I actually followed a dumb decision again. I followed a boyfriend because he made me feel like I had some sort of security, right? And he got into University of New Hampshire to play baseball. So I chose to go there instead of going to Syracuse, which is where I should have gone. And I studied communications there. Again, at Syracuse, I would have done much better and had a very quick line into what I wanted to do. You know, I wanted to be, my job that I always wanted, I wanted to be a news director. At a news station. I thought that was so much fun. And, you know, I love the news. I was always obsessed with the news and getting it right. So I went to University of New Hampshire. I graduated in 3 years because I didn't like it very much. I stuck out like a sore thumb and it just wasn't the school for me. So I buckled down and took extra classes and left early. And then my first job, I went back to New York and I got a job at CNBC and worked there.
Now, when you say stuck out like a sore thumb, what made you stick out?
Well, New Hampshire's like a little, you know, I'm a New Yorker, you know, I'm a little bit feisty. So like, you know, I always had the hair. I always had, you know, I always just stuck out. I drove this Nissan Pathfinder and everyone else was in like, you know, a little Honda or something. And like, again, I had a little extra money from my dad, and it's not a rich kid's school. It's like a school where people are skiing and athletes, you know? So the Pathfinder people were like, oh God, you know,
did you have rims on the Pathfinder and the system? Yeah,
probably,
and all that?
Probably, but it's not, it was like something that we found on like Craigslist in Connecticut, which is where my mom had a house. And like, so we just bought it. And by the way, my mom was like, if you want a car, this is the car you're going to get. We go to pick it up and it's a stick shift. I didn't know how to drive a fucking stick shift. She's like, well, you better learn now. I learned going out of that guy's driveway and driving, you know, the 20 minutes home on the highway. And that's like a metaphor for my life. It's like, I have to learn as I go along because no one is fucking helping me. It was terrible.
No, I get it.
I love that.
But I think even my first car was a stick shift. Maybe the kids today, of course, they're not going to learn on a stick shift, but I think everybody from, you know, that time, early 2000s, 90s, you had to learn on a stick shift.
Yeah,
you know?
I loved having a stick shift. I would love to have a stick shift in my car now. I thought it was fun.
Except in LA. All the hills, you roll back. Oh, that's stressful.
Yeah, probably. That would suck for sure.
Okay, so let's move forward to when was the first time you got married?
I was 26 years old, and I was... my boyfriend proposed to me and we were together for 3 years. And 3 weeks after he proposed to me, he was killed. So, and we lived together and everything. So that was, you know, a very big, obviously deal for me that I finally found this guy who I just idolized. I thought he was the greatest man ever. He was 6 years older than me. He had a job on Wall Street. He was so cool. He was so handsome. He was a swimmer at UCLA. Everybody looked up to him, you know, and he was 32 and he was about to be made managing partner, which was so young at the time. And he was killed. And it was the most terrible thing that has ever happened to me.
And I read the story where you said you were basically in a newsroom. You worked for
Bloomberg.
Mm-hmm. Bloomberg at the time. And the thing that struck me is you said when that tower went down, people watched a part of you die at that same time.
Well, yeah, I mean, they legitimately watched me watch Andy die because we're on a newsroom and we have hundreds of screens and they knew that I was talking to Andy for those 40 minutes or whatever it was. His was the second tower to get hit, but the first tower that fell, in case people can't kind of remember. And so when the first tower hit, we were talking to Andy about what he was seeing. He was on the 105th floor. So we were talking to him about, you know, what he was going through, what he was seeing, like if he was going to leave. And he had been in the World Trade Center bombing in 93. So he had said that they told him to stay and they were playing poker and they were going to go to the roof. And you know, I didn't have any fear that something would happen to him that day at all. You know, I was the connection with the guy named Dylan Radigan, who was stuck on air that morning as the anchor. And I was telling Dylan what Andy was seeing. And then next thing you know, I'm holding the phone in my hand, talking to Andy basically. And the second plane hit. And at first I remember everyone thought it might be fuselage exploding the phone is dead. And I remember like, I couldn't find my seat behind me. I was like, oh my God, this is terrible. But I didn't have that kind of fear where I like broke down. I was still working. I was like, okay, I kept calling him in between, you know, minutes would go by and the phone were dead. And we had a Bloomberg. I don't know if people know what that is. It's a computer that connects with everyone that has a Bloomberg. Yep. And I would DM him kind of, and it wouldn't go through. And I saw where the plane hit. We now figured out it was a plane and I knew he was above that. So of course, no one had the creativity. I hate using that word, but that is the word in their head to think that the tower would fall. And when it did fall, there was, it was chaos on the floor until that moment when the building tilted to the side and then fell into itself. And everyone kind of just looked at me because they knew that Andy was in that building. And there was we're all a smart group of people. They knew that there wasn't enough time, even if he had started to go down, that he would not have made it out.
Do you remember the last thing he said to you before the phone went dead?
Yeah. He said, I'm getting out of here. Cause you could hear on the phone, someone on the microphone saying, stay put, do not move, something along those lines of wording. Do not leave, you're safer where you are. And he, at that moment, was like, I've got to get out of here. I've got to get out of here. And that was the last thing he had said to me. So that's how in my head I knew he might start to go down. And then I thought, well, he's going to start to go up now that, but I knew when the plane hit, he was at his desk because he was on the phone with me. So
it's, I saw your tribute to him, probably last September. Mm-hmm. How does it make you feel knowing so many people still reach out about that and that how that picture that went around the world affected everyone's life?
Okay, so it was obviously the worst thing that happened to me and him, obviously, but it's so special to me that his name is known and will be known, and his story is a story that gets to be heard. And I've had criticism about that. I mean, I've literally been at ground zero and had people come up to me and say, like, you were only a fiance, stop talking, you don't know what love is like, you know, whatever it is that I trigger in them. But I'm not telling his story because of me. I'm telling his story because I want people to feel sorry for me, right? I'm telling his story because I want people to remember who Andy O'Grady was. It's really important to me. I would want that if something happened to me like that. So
And what was great about him?
He was just, you know, he was a gregarious guy. He was the most interesting person that would walk into a room. He had that team mentality, always brought people up. He didn't say a bad word about anyone. And everyone gravitated towards him. And, you know, if you were lucky enough to be in his orbit, you were lucky enough to be, you know, loved by him. You felt seen. He made you feel like the most important person in the room. And I always, as a young girl, felt credible and worthy because he chose me. So that was what was important about him.
Do you ever think, you know, let's be honest, you've had a lot of drama in your life that's gone public, but have you ever thought like how your life would have been if 9/11 didn't happen, you guys would have got married, how much in a different path your life would have took?
Yeah, of course. Like I would have gotten married. We already had I was looking at wedding dresses with my maid of honor, my grandmother. They were coming into town and at Vera Wang. And we had already picked out the wedding place. We were getting married in Palm Beach at Bethesda by the Sea, the church that Donald Trump got married in. And we were having the reception at the Everglades. And, you know, we probably would have lived in Long Island and maybe I would have had a couple kids. But, you know, then again, I don't want to idolize the situation because, you know, here we are 24 years later. I could have been divorced. Yeah. And like, you know, everyone's lives take a turn. You know, I'm very careful because it would be hard for me to live in the present if I always just thought it would have been this picture perfect life. And I think that's something important for people to remember who have lost someone. You can't always think that your life was supposed to go one way. That's not what life is. It's sliding doors. Yeah. It'll go one way or the other, and you got to live in the moment. So it may or may not have turned out with Andy, but what I do know is I learned so much about myself and lessons and how to treat a man and how to be treated by a man. So that for that, I thank him.
Now, I live in Las Vegas right now. This is where I live with my family. And I know you've lived in Las Vegas for a certain time. You were like the VIP, I guess you could call it maitre d'. You were like, if anybody came to town, they would reach out.
Because everyone takes it down a notch. I was the director of VIP operations for the number one nightclub in the entire world, Tap.
Yes. I used to go to that nightclub back in the day, too. That was my jam. What is one thing you love, though, about connecting with celebrities? Because the big whales or the big famous people that would come in, what is something you loved about connecting with those people?
I grew up with Jason and Noah, who owned Tao. And Jason asked me to come. He was my first boyfriend when I was 12. And he was like, hey, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm leaving my husband. The time I had been married to our childhood friend for a year and I wanted out. And so he said, come out here and help me open it up. And I ended up staying. So, and I didn't have history in that world at all. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't have a boob job. I didn't have anything fake on me. It was just this like average girl from New York that had had a tough life that came out there, you know, and I happened to be very, very good at what he needed to be good at. And so I ended up staying and I became known as like the first lady of Vegas because I was able to have a conversation with anyone from the guy buying a bottle of beer to the biggest whale that came in the room to the guy that the, you know, was playing craps or whatever it was in the hotel and winning millions of dollars. I had to handle them all. Plus, I was a good extension of the owners because they would never want to show up because all of their friends wanted to come in for free. So I had to ask for credit cards from everybody and, you know, and be a tough girl. So I was very good at doing all those things. And we made a ton of money. I personally, you know, feel like I was very helpful in that. I knew how to sit a room. I knew how to put people that were spending money next to pretty girls or whatever it was, introducing people. And listen, articles were done after the fact when I became famous again, that I was a madam and all these things. And that is absolutely not what I was. I was good at my job, which meant I made money for the club. And I always reiterated to all the girls that work there, never sleep with a client. You will lose a client that way. Just flirt with them and make them have the best times of their life. So I was definitely a connector. And it's so funny. Somebody was talking to me about my Rolodex just yesterday. I still have like 9,000 phone numbers in my phone of very famous names just because they were clients of mine at the club.
Look, I've been in the industry for a while, and my side was more of interviewing them and getting to know them. Are you still blown away? Because sometimes a celebrity will still call me to check in to say hi, and I'm still kind of just blown away that this person, like, even reaches out to me. Are you still like that too? Where you're like, I can't believe this person knows me and actually cares.
Yeah. I mean, it's like my relationship with them has obviously changed throughout the years because I knew them as someone who was like their gatekeeper and hiding their secrets. And then I became the person in the press. And then it was like, it switched over that I became famous, you know? So when I run into them, it's a weird situation. Like, for example, tonight for my show, I'm interviewing Kathy Griffin. Okay. Kathy Griffin was someone who used to make fun of me and, you know, I was in her bits or whatever, or, you know, and we ran into each other one night at an event and she was like, oh my God, Rachel, you could tell I need to take a picture because I was a joke, right, at the time. And so now here I am, she's coming on my show and I'm talking to her about her life and the fact that we have something in common. The whole world hated us for a little while, you know, and what that's like. And I love that I can talk to, I mean, I've had so many celebrities on my show and I know so many celebrities, but I think people have a different level of knowing me from before or after what happened, you know? And, but I think all in all, you know, I actually like the people that knew me from before because they're like, oh, I knew her when she was like a hustler. She's always been the same person. People will tell you I'm always the same person.
Now what's interesting is I know, with the Tiger Woods situation, the NDA came in effect. And even though money was given to you to sign the NDA, you didn't really know the magnitude of it at the time you signed and got some money. Looking back, would you have done it? And what did it prevent you from doing?
Without getting into too much detail, you must have read the New York Times story or something to even be saying it that clearly. But the New York Times did a very long piece on this exact topic. And I did not know what I was signing. I didn't know that it would be taking away my voice. I didn't know that it would be taking away agency to be a person before and after, but I would just be stuck in that one moment. And I think it's so important for people to know that being able to share your story and tell your and have your own voice and have, you know, be able to claim your name is a really important thing. And by signing away anything, I was getting myself into a world of, you know, shit for the rest of my life wearing a scarlet letter. And it's been hard to this day. It still lives with me. And I've found that I've had to climb out of a barrel in every situation just because people are stuck on that one moment. And that's a really terrible place to be just because I couldn't share my story. And a lot of people will be like, well, so you want to just kiss and tell and you want to get that story out? That's not even what I'm referring to. I'm referring to you want to be able to show who you are as a person. I actually, in my NDA, was prevented from having any kind of a job, a life. It was the biggest story, still is in some way. The people still talk about it. And I wasn't allowed to even have a say. Like if people were talking about it, I'd be like, I know you want to talk about this, but it's not something I could talk about, which just made me sound crazy. I mean, you know,
so yeah, it made a
place to be in.
Anytime you can't defend yourself, it kind of is an omission.
Yeah.
You know, when you can't defend yourself, when you want to defend yourself, but you sign something, people don't know your story. And they were like, well, you know, right. it must be true. Everything they write must be true because you can't defend yourself. I can only imagine.
Yeah. And in the absence of truth, you know, all this other, these details get thrown in that are just so ridiculous, and they forget that you're a person, and they forget that there's complexities in human nature of why people do things, you know, and I wish that I could say, but let me explain to you what really happened, because that is not what happened or why I would do that. I'm a good person. I don't cheat on people. I believe in monogamy. I believe in love, people have really put what I trigger. I mean, you know, their hatred about a lot of things that go on in their own life that came on to me for a very long time.
Do you ever wonder why hatred is pointed at you instead of the person that, like Tiger or any other guys that go through these situations? It seems like the hatred is put on the woman where it's a two-way street.
Yeah, I mean, like, let's talk about Vanderpump for a minute. Like, that was such a huge scandal. I thought it was really dumb, actually, that people got so emotionally invested in this. The way that people were talking to Rachel, Raquel, whatever her name is, I thought that was terrible. And I was shocked that she didn't try to commit suicide. Like, I thought that was awful. But then again, that's a show. Like, what happened was my life, and I got that. And so I think they made, what's his name, Tom, they kind of dismissed him. It was like, he was just a fucking idiot that just slept with anyone and cheated. And then she's the villain. She's the monster, Rachel. And then poor Ariana, whatever the girlfriend's name was, poor her. But people forget there's a lot of things that go into why that went down and what happened. No one has a perfect relationship, and that's why they cheat. No one is a cheater without being told certain things or made to feel comfortable to do that. There's three people in that situation. By the way, none of us are entitled to know any of it. I believe it's between them, but the level of anger towards it was terrible. So do I wonder about it? Yeah, it always happens. I think it's unfair. I think that people still see my name. Like, if I'm on a dating app, some guys won't date me because they're like, oh yeah, there's that fucking mistress, you know, like, she's not worthy of being a wife, or, you know, whatever the situation, I still have that scarlet letter, and it's terrible because that is not who I am. But imagine the thing that you feel most guilty about or that you're embarrassed about, that's the one thing people remember you for, because it's plastered everywhere, never to go away. It's like a shame you have to live with forever, and that's not even who you are. It was like a mistake.
Yeah, if a guy goes on a date with you, his friends or people close to him going saying, oh, that's the Tiger Woods girl. That's what they would say. And no matter what you do to change your life, you're always going to be, you know, on the internet, remembered as that.
Yeah. But even in my own private circles, I mean, it's like, I have found, no matter where I move, no matter what I do, no matter how I try and reinvent myself, it's always Rachel, you could tell, comma, that. And it's obviously been very difficult. And I've had to retrain my brain to know that that's not where my worth, you know, like, that I'm worthy beyond that. And I'm someone else. But what the public did to me and the media did to me after that scandal was so terrible that was ingrained in my head.
So look, at least by the stories that I read on the internet, what are some telltale signs? Because you've been involved with a couple of married men, correct? Or in relationships, correct?
Well, wait, who are we talking about?
Is it David Boreanaz?
Okay, right, sure. But if you want to break that down, because I would like to explain that for a second. Yes. Nobody brings that up anymore, but I would like to tell you, when I met David, he came into my club. And he had come into the club a few times as a married man. The last time he came into the club, he said that he was separated from his wife. They were going to be getting a divorce, but it wasn't public. Nobody knew about it. He was living in the guest house of his property, whatever. Later on, he says, I have something to tell. So we start to date. He says, I have something to tell you. We found out that Jamie's pregnant and she's going to have the baby and it's not a big deal. We're going to co-parent separately. I'm still living in the guest house and we have a son and this makes sense. I believed him. Why wouldn't I believe him? I mean, what, you know, I'm not an investigator. I'm a girl working in a club and I fell for this guy who was dreamy, right? And saying all the right things. The only time, and listen, this guy called me 80 times a day from the second he went to sleep to the second he woke, like in the middle of the night, waking up and then all through the day. He lived in LA. I lived in New York. I didn't know. I would go on trips with him. The way I found out that he was still with his wife was by reading it on TMZ when she, I guess, I don't really remember the details, but she was pregnant she was going into labor, and he made some statement about how excited they are for their kid. And he calls me from the hospital and he's like, yeah, you know, we just are putting that out there that, you know, we're still together because we don't want to upset our son. So listen, I'm not making excuses for me being ignorant about it. And I probably overlooked a lot of red flags because I wanted to believe it. But that comes also from my background. Like, I had such a shitty experience with men dying, being killed by terrorists, and the marriage is not lasting. Like, I just wanted to feel loved, and he made me feel loved. And it was, you know, it was dumb, but that's the story behind that.
Yeah. It's interesting that, like, being involved in a couple married men, how could you actually get married and trust another man? That's my question to you. Cause you,
I know men very well. So
no, you do. That's what I'm saying is, like, how do you get married knowing you've been on the other side of it and saying, yeah, I can trust a man to not cheat on me?
It's a really good question. Well, I haven't gotten married, so there's your first thing. I haven't had relationships that have lasted more than 3 years. I will tell you, none of the relationships I've been in, infidelity was ever an issue, as far as I know. Like, that was not where it stemmed from. But that is a fear that I have. I want to be married. I want to have a relationship with someone that is a witness to my life, that I can trust more than anything, that's my best friend, that I can go through the day and think about everything that happened to me so I can tell it to that person and feel like there's an us. I hope that that exists. I see it with other people. I mean, I see that people say they're in good relationships, but listen, I have very close friends and I know that they've cheated. I know that they're not telling the truth sometimes even to me. So about what's going on in their relationships, and I still love them as a person, but this is why I think I'm closed off to letting myself be that vulnerable, because I do know men that well, and I have high expectations for what I want to be in.
Now, you're a mom to some dogs and also a daughter.
Yeah.
Has the conversation come up with you and your past with your daughter yet? And if so, when does that happen? When do you see that happening?
A long time ago. Meaning, I've never had to have the conversation, but I remember when he was in that car accident more recently, in the last couple, 5 years, whatever it's been, and it was all over the screen, and my phone was ringing off the hook, and she has my old cell phone. And so people found my old number and were calling her trying to get a statement. And she was like, Mom, they're calling about, you know, a statement about Tiger. I've never had to have a conversation with her. She's very aware. And she's very mature. She's almost 12, going on like 18. She thinks that I am a great person. She sees how I am with men, with people, with relationships. She, she doesn't have any questions. And if she
does, does it ever come home from school?
She has told me that people have, brought up my name or Googled me, like in science class where they get their computers. And I think at their age, they haven't gotten to the stage where they're looking at those things, because now I feel like I'm doing enough that other things are coming up ahead of that, you know, as opposed to those headlines. Especially with my show and who I'm interviewing, mm-hmm. and I'm in the press more for all that kind of stuff. So I think her friends just see that I'm someone who's quote unquote famous, someone that people know. Sometimes paparazzi follows me. There's pictures of Wyatt online. You know, you can Google Wyatt's name. And I think her friends are like, oh, you're famous to her. And she's like, no, my mom is. And they say why. And she says, because she has a show. And that's, you know, that's it.
And that's it. OnlyFans. I want to talk about this. I know you don't have one. This is what I'm going to tell you is I was podcasting with another comedian, because I do stand up and, you know, I act, I host and stuff like that. But we were talking about if we could do an OnlyFans, like, what would it be? And the girl I was interviewing said she loves Britney Spears. She goes, I would just teach Britney Spears dance moves. I go, I don't know if that would sell, but great. Like, if you could have
women, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. But if you could sell something on OnlyFans, what do you think you would specialize in?
Well, let me start by saying that if I could do an OnlyFans page, I would do it quicker than I could hit end on this thing. Like, I think that it is such a great way to make extra cash. And as I said, I'm a hustler for shit like that. I always want the side job. I'll do anything. Like, I think, again, I have no one supporting me, so I believe in making as much money as I can when I still have it. Do I want to take off all my clothes? No, but by the way, I still look pretty good for 49 years old. So if I had to, I would. You know, I had an offer to do OnlyFans once, and I did chicken out because they wanted really explicit stuff. And because of my daughter, she was like 9 at the time. I was like, no. And I just thought it was inappropriate. But now would I do it? Yeah. My mother used to be a foot model. I have the best feet ever.
See, that's what I was saying. I was telling, look, I had this discussion with my wife. I said, my wife's feet are beautiful, but I think I have gorgeous feet. I'm not going to show you right now because I haven't got them pedicured. But I will tell you this. I think my thing would be feet. I would put my feet on OnlyFans if I ever did anything.
Do you think your feet? You think women have a fetish for feet?
I don't care who has a fetish for it. That's the thing I would specialize in. Feet. Okay. My feet are amazing.
Right. Okay. I love that. My feet are really good. Okay. But, you know, I've had a couple girls on my podcast that are OnlyFans stars, big ones. Like one girl who was a school teacher got fired because they found out she had OnlyFans, and now she makes so much money on OnlyFans and teaches other women how to do it. And another girl who was a pastor who then decided she wanted to come out as being queer and then does stripping on OnlyFans and does lessons and makes millions of dollars. I love these girls. I think they are amazing and have something going. But the one thing that they have both told me that they run specials on because they have so much of it coming in is, I don't know if this is appropriate for your show, but doing dick ratings. I would be great at doing dick ratings. I would do it.
Wait a minute. How does that work? People just send you that or what?
Well, yeah. So I asked the same question, but you know how, you don't know, cause you're not a girl, but guys are idiots and they send you their dick pics once in a while.
Yep.
Cause they think it's cool. I would love to be in the position where I'm getting paid to be doing a dick rating. So you could send me your dick and I could say, all right, here's what it is on a scale of 1 to 10. Here's how it is with height, girth, cleanliness, you know, the way that you took the picture, all sorts of things. Cause it's like a good, you know, it's a good way for them to get back into the world with women and make sure that they're, you know, clean and looking presentable. It's like a good, you know, we're all being patriots.
Or making sure they're manicured and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly.
But seriously, they're not sending it in for that. They just want you to see it.
Of course.
Because if a man needs to have a person tell him if it looks good or not, it doesn't look good.
Well, maybe that's true. It's an ego thing. But yeah, guys, I mean, I will say when you do send dick pics to women, for the most part, we don't think they're that cute.
Wait. Do you get a lot of those?
I do.
So you just open your DM and bam, there it is.
Yeah. That like, hey, cool. Wouldn't you like this? Or did tigers look like this? I mean, stupid shit.
Yeah. Speaking about that, what did, not dicks or anything, speaking about that, the lady that's going through her NDA with Tiger Woods right now, how do you feel about that?
I mean, she made a big mistake by trying to make it public. I mean, I know exactly what she did. The thing with NDAs is you have to go through arbitration to deal with them. And arbitration is where NDAs go to die. It's like a burying ground because nobody knows what happens in that room. And usually when you're up against a monster of suits and men and money, and it's just you as a woman or whoever it is, the quote unquote victim, you're outnumbered. And so I think she was trying to play her cards in the court of public opinion and get things in a real court so that people could see what was going on because she felt like she was probably losing her voice. But you know, the thing with her is obviously she either signed something or she was dumb that when she did date him, she didn't take the opportunity to have people know her as who she was because then she could have a life outside of him. They just knew her as Erica Herman. And maybe he wanted it that way, but you know, she now wanted to tell her story or become famous after the fact. That doesn't make any sense. So she should have taken the opportunity when she was with him to write a song, open a store, whatever the hell, you know, she wanted to do, create a restaurant. I think she was like a manager in his restaurant. She should have taken the opportunity because then she would have been somebody that people could interview about that, knowing that they were really interviewing her because she's the ex, but it gave her, you know, so I thought that was a pretty dumb move. But
it's kind of interesting. Like when I tell friends that have been on reality shows, like if you go on a reality show, have something to sell. Don't just go on to be on, you know?
Well, they get so excited about being famous. They don't realize that it's, first of all, you will become famous, but for whatever nonsense happens on the show, unless you have something exciting to sell. So I totally agree with that. But have you been watching things like Love is Blind and The Traitors?
So my wife loves Love is Blind. She actually cheated on me by starting it without me. Yeah. Yeah. So I didn't get to watch this season, but I did watch the end. I saw the final episode. And oh man, that was crushing. I mean, it was one was happy, one I don't want to give it away if people, but I love that. I love, you know what I love about it is, would you ever do a show like that, by the way? Love is Blind.
Oh my God, I say on every one of my shows, if there's a producer listening or someone at Netflix, I want to be on Love is Blind. Like, it should be like either a second chance show. So for people in their 40s that have kids that are divorced, or like kind of a whatever you want to call celebrity show, people that, you know, have been in the news and might have a really hard time meeting someone based on what people read about them. And, you know, you want to meet them behind a wall. I think that would be amazing. I would do it in a second. Do you know how hard it is to meet a man in your 40s, especially when you're well known? Obviously, you don't know. But I mean, I think it's easier to get, like, you know, kidnapped by terrorists than it is.
Let's be honest. You don't have a problem meeting men. You have problem meeting the right men.
Correct. Okay. I meet men all the time. I don't find them interesting because, listen, I've been with some really powerful, great, interesting men. And so you have to come to play, you know, if you're going to be with me. Because I've also lived a really interesting life, you know? Like,
yeah.
Do you have anyone you could set me up with?
No. My friends, my guy friends that are single are... I call them those guys. They're those guys. You know what I mean? You know what I'm talking like? Oh, those guys. Yeah. They're the guys.
That's what I'm saying. It's hard out there.
Because I believe with guys, once they reach a certain age, like I'm 49 as well. Once you reach a certain age and they're like 47, 48, I don't think marriage is in their cards. And I think some people will just accept, well, I'm not going to be married, you know?
Yeah. Maybe. I mean, I think eventually they will get the fear that they don't want to grow old alone and they'll pick someone, but it'll be a much younger woman. Like, because I'm 49, I feel like my pool is now like 55 to 65, which blows, by the way.
Would you? You don't think a guy that's like 37, 38 would want to go out with you?
Yeah, they do all the time. As I've been talking to you, my phone's blowing up by someone that it calls me every day. I'm not dating a younger man. I was married to a guy 10 years younger.
Oh, come on, stop it.
I'm not doing it. I was married to someone 10 years younger than me. And the role reversal, I want to be the woman. I already have A-type personality issues. I already am very tough. I want to be the woman in the situation. I really do.
But dealing with 55 to 65 year old men, that's not favorable for you. I mean, you're talking about going to bed at 8:30.
Some way, shape, or form. Yeah. I mean, listen, it's favorable because usually they're successful and they can make my life a little easier. But yeah, it comes with some issues. You got to take some pills. You got to, you know, I don't know. Whatever.
Yeah.
But sometimes you're like, let's go over. Move on to the next day.
All right. Three things a guy must have, because you're single. She's looking. People, she's looking. Okay. Three things a guy must have.
Three things. Okay. Loyalty.
Yes.
Like being a family man, loyalty, same thing in my opinion. Mm-hmm. A nice bank account.
Okay. Important.
It is, just because at my age, it's like, I can't work with someone who's like trying to just live in my guest bedroom. Do you know what I mean? Can't be like a dog. Not that there's anything wrong with it, but I want a motivated guy, you know?
Yeah, a motivated guy. But motivated guys at that age are usually successful.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, exactly. I don't need someone in tears on the couch because they're like, oh my God, can you pay my rent again? You know, whatever.
Have you ever dated a guy where you had to pay their bills?
Yes.
And why did you date them? Was it more a sex thing?
Because, you know, Dr. Drew, who I love, gave me great advice, you know, that you pick someone with no red flags and someone who's very straight line like this and someone that doesn't make your life up and down. And I picked the person based on the fact that he was sweet, nice, good looking, came from a good family. But then I was like his mom.
What's your favorite thing about doing your own podcast? Getting your voice out, I would imagine.
Yeah, I love having a podcast. So my podcast is called Misunderstood. It's about people that have been reduced to a single headline and are on a mission to change their narrative. So I love having the platform where I'm not talking about me, but a little bit of me comes out in every episode because I can share my experience of being in their same experience. But I also get to meet people. Listen, I do all my own booking. So I get to pick the people that I find to be the most interesting, and I want to hear their story. So that's why I have Kathy Griffin on. But I've had everyone from, you know, Doc Gooden from the Yankees. I've had Rudy Giuliani. I've had Cato Kaelin. You know, I've literally had so many people from so many different walks of life because I want to hear their story and I want to hear their version from their side as opposed to the media. And I love making friends that have been in a similar situation. But, you know, like Crystal Hefner, I just had on a couple of weeks ago because she had her book out. I found her fascinating because of what she's gone through. And I share a lot of those same feelings of what she's gone through. So I feel like in everyone I meet, I learn a little bit more about myself through what they've gone through. And I love that.
This is something I always ask celebrities when I work for entertainment news. What's the one headline you ever read about yourself that affected you the most and that was absolutely false? Because most people remember that headline.
Well, I mean, I mentioned it earlier. The New Yorker, I think it was, in huge letters, Rachel, you could tell is not a madam. And it had a picture of me looking like a total madam. And it was like a whole thing, you know, about my job in the nightclub business and breaking it down. But that headline really stood out to me. But, you know, all those terrible headlines, TMZ has a way of writing. There's too many to mention, you know, making it seem like I was the worst kind of woman out there. You know, men or women clutch your men. Rachel, you could tell is in town. Like, that kind of thing. Like just terrible things that were just not who I was. So, I mean, listen, I was a front page story. I have been on the cover of the New York Post between September 11th and the Tiger Woods scandal and other things more times than a regular person. You know what I mean? So it's really incredible the headlines that I have gotten, but so many of them were so terrible.
What?
I can't pick one, to be honest.
Let's fast forward and not to get too dark. But at the end of it all, you know, we all ride in this thing called life. But at the end of it all, what's the headline you would want for yourself?
I would love for there to be a headline about me having a comeback, right? Like me being able to be like, oh, that girl, there was a stand up and cheer moment for that girl that she deserves because she was so downtrodden and people didn't believe in her and she didn't have, you know, what it took in our minds to like have a comeback and whether that is something with my podcast turning into a show or marrying a great guy that I fall in love with and feeling like there's this happily ever after moment. Like to me, that would be like the headline that I would love to die knowing happened, you know?
That's awesome. That's awesome. Rachel, it was very good to get to know you. I had fun on this podcast. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. Misunderstood. You can listen to it everywhere. Is it followed with a YouTube page as well? Like with clips and stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. They have full episodes and the clips are broken down as well, but we're on everywhere you get your podcast, Apple, Spotify, and it's Misunderstood, spelled M-I-S-S, understood with Rachel Yucatel.
That's right. All right, Rachel. Thank you so much.
Thank you.